most current information that's available to us right now. As the chair said, the contents of these two reports are summarized somewhat on the two larger tables. And I'm not going to specifically refer to those tables either, but I have some more highly summarized information from those. I want to just kind of reiterate what we've been talking about lately, and that is that this is a historical perspective, and we are at a time of great change economically in this country, so there's no guarantee that these ratings or factors or measurements will be similar going forward, but this is what we have to work with at the time. So, to start, and I'm not doing a PowerPoint, but let me see if I can see. These are the factors that Standard & Poor's looks at, and I don't know if everyone can see that. This is not in your packet. These are the factors that they look at when they're analyzing a state's fiscal management. The first one is revenue and expenditure assumptions, and that's essentially how we forecast what's coming up in the future. The second is budget amendments and updates, and that's how a state would monitor its budget throughout the budgetary period and its ability to make any adjustments that are needed. The third is long-term financial planning. That's how a state looks at changes and revenues, and also how it looks at its future obligations, not just capital obligations, but enrollments in K-12 education, pension obligations, and other obligations of the state. Then there's long-term capital planning, that's pretty obvious. The bottom two are the ones that we're going to kind of focus on today, and that's debt management policies. Those are the guidelines that deal with the issuance of debt, its affordability, and the type of debt that a state is allowed to issue. And finally, it's reserve and liquidity policy, which is the size of the various budget reserves that a state might have, how they're funded, and how they're used. And these can be rainy day funds, budget stabilization funds, or, as in Minnesota, we have a cash flow account. Generally, Standard & Poor's rate states either strong, which means that they have well embedded and established practices, good, which means the practices exist in most of these areas, but they're not as formal or as monitored as regularly. Standard, which is they have adequate policies, but not in all of the areas that they look at. And finally, vulnerable, where the policies are lacking to support the quality of debt that would be issued. And as of this July 2007 time period, 16 of the states were ranked strong, 33 were ranked good, and one was standard. None were vulnerable. And then finally...
And the standard was California, I believe, right?
I believe that's correct. And then finally, I just want to have kind of a consistent, have you understand what at least Standard & Poor's means by debt. They are looking at all components of tax-supported debt, and that means general obligation bonds, appropriation obligations, and in Minnesota we have several of these. For example, the general fund appropriation for the University of Minnesota Stadium, and bioscience facilities, and for the nonprofit housing bonds. And then they also include special tax bonds that are backed by sales taxes, income taxes, or gas taxes. And clearly in Minnesota we have transportation bonds that are backed by sales tax, or gas taxes. The next thing, I'm going to take a look at the states that actually are have a AAA rating by Standard & Poor's, and this information is in your packet. And the first characteristics that we're going to look at are just who are these states? And there's nine of them. They're listed here. Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Maryland, Minnesota, Missouri, North Carolina, Utah, and Virginia. And from the map, and from our own knowledge of geography, of course, we can see that they're kind of clustered along the Atlantic coast, south of Pennsylvania. Minnesota and Missouri are the only Midwestern states, and Utah is the only Western state in this group. And they range from being very small states like Delaware to quite large states and growing rapidly like Florida. You can see that their budgets, and this 2009 expenditure amount comes from a recent December publication of the National Governors Association, and so it's consistent across all states. You can see that they range from relatively small budgets to very large budgets. Minnesota tends to be kind of in the middle of the state. Usually the budgets are related to the population. States that are large in size have large budgets. Smaller states have smaller budgets. That's not too surprising. Minnesota is somewhat different. We have a large per capita income. We have large personal income in this state, and our budget tends to reflect that more than our population amount. And the reserves also are consistent with, tend to be consistent with the size of the budget. Again, Minnesota is somewhat an anomaly in this. If you would have looked at this a year ago, we would have had a larger reserve that was more consistent with the size of our budget, but the actions taken in the 2008 legislature reduced the size of our reserve, and so we're somewhat out of sync with that. The next thing that I want to look at is kind of the debt management characteristics of these states. And again, this information is included in some of the larger tables you have more in more detail. This chart shows that measurements of the affordability of debt, or how much debt a state has, these AAA rated states have, and it's based on, the first column is the amount of debt as a percent of personal income, and it's ranked nationally, not in this group of nine states. The second category is the amount of debt, total debt in millions of dollars, and then the amount of debt per capita, and again it's ranked nationally. And then finally, debt service as a percent of general government expenditures. This is simply a snapshot of the debt characteristics of these states at a certain point in time. And what we can see from this, as we saw in the previous slide, is that there's a lot of variability. You can't say all of these states are the same size, or they have the same debt characteristics, or they're low debt or high debt states. All you can say is that there's a lot of variability. Delaware, which is one of the AAA rated states, has a high level of debt. It's ranked fifth in the nation. It devotes 5.3% of its personal income to debt. It's low in its actual total amount of debt because it's a relatively small state. But on a per capita basis, it's sixth in the nation. And it devotes 4.2% of debt service compared to general government expenditure. So it essentially is a high debt state. If you look at a state like Missouri, which is also in this group of AAA states, it's a very low debt state. It only uses 0.9% of its personal income for debt. It's ranked 42nd on the basis of per capita, and it only uses 2% of debt service is 2% of general government expenditure. So it's hard to come up with a unifying theme when you look at these states and know why they're being judged to have a AAA rating. It certainly isn't on any single factor that's here. Minnesota, again, is somewhat in the middle of the pack, both in this group of nine states and nationally. We rank 25th in the nation of the amount of debt as a percent of personal income, devoting 2.1% of our personal income to debt. And remember, Minnesota has a high personal income, so that provides us with some resources. But it's like fourth we rank about fourth within this group of states, of AAA rated states. We're also in the middle in the total amount of debt, and we're kind of in the middle in the amount of debt per capita, with $866 worth of debt per capita. And at this time, by their measures of debt service, we were at 2.8% of general government expenditures for debt service. We could talk more about what all of these various measures mean and how different states are, but clearly there must be a management component to how they achieve their rating. And in the report that was done in 2007, Standard & Poor's highlighted some of these characteristics that distinguish the various states that have AAA ratings. I'm going to kind of summarize those quickly, and if you have questions, I can try to answer them. Delaware, for example, I'm going to focus on the two measures that I mentioned earlier, the first one being debt guidelines, and the second one is reserves. Most of these states, I would say virtually all of these states, rank quite highly on how they do forecasts, how they issue their debts, and the other criteria. There's a little more variability in these last two characteristics. So let's start with Delaware, a small state, a high debt state, high personal income. It has extensive debt affordability guidelines according to Standard & Poor's. It requires new tax-supported debt to be less than 5% of its estimated general fund revenues. And it has a constitutionally required budget reserve that is funded at 5% of general fund revenues. By contrast, Florida, which is a large state, and its debt burden is more modest than Delaware's, also has formal debt management policies. It, too, has a constitutionally required budget stabilization fund that's also set at 5% of prior year's collections. So those two states are quite similar. Georgia, which is one of the states in this group of AAA-rated states that was ranked as good, rather the others were strong, has formal debt management policies that are based on the ratio of debt service to spending, debt to personal income, and debt per capita. So it has a multifaceted test, somewhat like Minnesota does. It has a statutory rainy day fund, not a constitutional one. And the rainy day fund requires up to about 10% of net revenues per year to be deposited into it. Maryland, again, one of those states that's kind of in the middle. It isn't remarkable on any of these measures, except that it has a fairly high percentage of debt service to general government expenditures of 4.7%. It's nearly 5%, much higher than a state like Minnesota or North Carolina. It has formal debt management policies that are based on debt to personal income and debt service to expenditures. It has a statutory rainy day fund, not a constitutional one, and it is consistently maintained at 5%. Minnesota, I'm only going to mention Minnesota because the Department of Finance is the expert on Minnesota and their debt policies, and they're going to talk more. But what Standard & Poor's notes about Minnesota is that it does have this 20-year history of debt management policies that track the aggregate debt to personal income and general fund expenditures. It notes that we consult these guidelines whenever we issue debt, and that there are formal reserve policies in Minnesota that allocate specific dollar amounts for the cash flow account and the budget reserve. That's what they find notable about Minnesota. Missouri, by contrast, is a AAA-rated state. It's ranked good on these characteristics, not strong. It has no formal written policies or guidelines for debt management. It does have a constitutional requirement that requires a vote of the population of the electorate before any GO bonds can be let. So it requires voter approval for bonding, which is one of the reasons they have such low debt. And it has a constitutional requirement for the governor to maintain its reserves at 7.5% of the prior year collection. North Carolina is a large state again. It's kind of in the middle of the debt burden. It has a very low proportion of debt service to government expenditures at 2%. And but it uses what Standard & Poor's notes about North Carolina is that it uses debt affordability modeling, not just guidelines, but modeling, to set target ratios and to limit the issuance of debt. It has formal reserve requirements, and they have in North Carolina they have several reserves. One is a reserve account that is set at 8% of spending, and the other is a reserve account that may be of interest to this committee. It's a repair and renovation reserve that's funded at 3% of the estimated replacement cost of state buildings. So they have, at least they have the structure for robust reserves. In Utah, which is also a good rated state, a AAA state, but it has a good rating on these policy issues, it also has no separate debt management policy. It doesn't have guidelines in place. But what it does do is issue bonds with very short maturities, 10 years or less. And it has a rainy day policy of establishing a fund of 6% of general fund and school funds. All states are different in how they use their money, and you know, clearly in Utah they have a general fund and they have school funds, and so they combine the two to establish their rainy day fund. And finally, Virginia has a statutory limit on debt that's set at 1.15 times the average receipt of sales and income taxes, so general state taxes, over the past 3 years, or kind of a moving average limit on their debt of general sales receipts. It's the only state in this group that has a swap, interest rate swap, and derivative guidelines in place. However, they have not used them. They don't have any of these agreements. They also have a constitutional budget stabilization fund with a formula that provides for the annual funding of this fund, and also constitutional provisions that govern withdrawals from the fund. So those are the management policies of the AAA-rated states. And essentially, if I can review for just a minute, we found out that these states vary in size. They're all over the U.S., essentially. They vary a lot in how much of their resources they devote to debt. They vary a lot in how much of a burden it is on their citizens in terms of per capita measures and personal income measures. They vary a lot in whether there's a constitutional or a statutory or no requirement for debt guidelines. And they vary a lot in the establishment of reserve funds and the funding of reserve funds. So when I was coming to draw conclusions on this, the message seems to be that states that manage their budgets well, manage their resources well, are recognized for that effort. And the bond rating seems to follow a good management policy. There isn't one characteristic that you can point to say, if you have this, you will get a AAA rating, or if you abide by this, you will get a AAA rating, or if your ratio doesn't exceed a certain number, you'll get a AAA rating. They're simply reviewing these states. There doesn't seem to be one trigger factor, but rather a combination of how these states manage their budgets and their resources and work within their laws.
Questions of were you concluding your questions? Yes, Representative Riddle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Novak, on the debt service percent of general government expenditures, Minnesota hit 2.8, and I believe we've frequently been told that if we exceed 3%, that would jeopardize our bond rating. Now, I see that there are six states here that are above 3%, and just wonder what factors are involved, why they are rated with AAA bond ratings and have a above 3% limit.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, I don't know what the specific requirements are for a top-level capacity in those states that have higher than Minnesota does. It may be that their guidelines allow them to go further than our guidelines do at the current time. And the rating agencies recognize that they are following their own guidelines and are consistent in how they follow them. But clearly, according to the rating agencies, that isn't in and of itself a make-or-break criteria.
But what I heard you say, Ms. Novak, is so we were looking at the seven states with AAA bond rating, as Minnesota has, and what I heard you say as you summarized this sheet is there are no similar characteristics. Some have formal debt service guidelines, some don't. Some have very strict cash reserve, and some don't. But in your opening comments, what you said is management, that kind of overall management. How do they manage their budget as a fiscally responsible state becomes, presumably, the overriding factor or the the strong message to the rating agency. Would that be fair?
Madam Chair, I believe that is a correct assessment of how they look at faith, and that's what the one report talked about, the March 2007 report. There's this series of management criteria that they evaluate, and those were the seven kind of criteria that I had up earlier. I'm not sure.
We were going to make copies, I think, of those two sheets at some point so that they...
These are the seven criteria that they specified in their report on how they analyze state. And one of the rationales for their report was to try to make the process a bit more transparent.
That sounds like the summary that might be an answer to his, and so when you have finished with it, we'll have the pages make copies. Did you have a follow-up question? Or at all?
Not really, Madam Chair, but I could say, just I guess to summarize then, that the 3% really has nothing to do with Standard and Poor's. It's something that Minnesota has established.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, it is something that Minnesota has established. It has been our guideline for a very long time, and they do recognize that it has been our guideline and that we have adhered to that guideline for a very long time, been within it. Other states that have other guidelines are also recognized for following their guidelines, which may be different from ours.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then Ms. Novak, real quickly then, and establishing guidelines that have been set by the state is one of the criteria that Standard and Poor's uses.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, that's correct. They look
except
at
Ms. Novak, I would point out you've just given us of the state,
yes.
Seven of them have no formal debt service guideline. Missouri and...
That's seven. Missouri and Utah, I believe.
Missouri and Utah have no overall guideline.
Right, no written policies and no guidelines. So it's something that they look at. It's clearly not, again, a make-or-break condition for getting a AAA bond rating.
Thank you.
Representative Mullery.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Novak, the debt service as percent of general government expenditures, how much different is that from this? We go by something like 3% of non-dedicated revenue or something like that. How would that compare to the standard? I assume Standard and Poor's doesn't look at our guideline. Is there any way to know what other states have with, like, on our guideline?
Now, I will say, relative to Minnesota, the department is going to give you specifics, and you're putting us in the context, so you might, if you want to answer the broad question, and then we're going to get the very specific information in the next presentation
I'm sure. I was just trying to get whether there's a comparison between this type of a guideline and our guideline, and if so, what, and is there any statistics on our guideline as to how other states use a percentage?
I can answer a bit, because I gave Ms. Novak this assignment, and I think what we discovered is, it is, if you look at the top seven states, or I guess this is nine, of those who have AAA bond ratings, the one thing you can clearly say is there aren't a universal set of characteristics that say if you follow these characteristics, you're going to have AAA bond rating. What she demonstrated, I think, with the outline is sort of the opposite is the case. Those characteristics are all over the map, but so no one formula automatically leads to a AAA bond rating. Would that be fair?
Madam Chair, I believe that is a very fair statement. And kind of to Representative Mullery's question, the debt service as a percent of general government expenditures is slightly different than our 3% guideline. It's somewhat similar, but it's, I believe, a little bit more expansive because they include in their definition of debt things that we don't include for that 3% measure, such as the general fund appropriations that back the University of Minnesota Football Stadium, the nonprofit housing fund.
And so we can revisit that question, I think, after the department makes its presentation. Representative Pawlowski.
Madam Chair, my question may fall with the department, but
okay.
I'm going to ask it now.
Okay.
If she can't answer, we can bring it up. My question, Ms. Novak, is we projected into the budget deficit a bonding bill in 09 of $120 million and a bonding bill in 10 of $725 million. Now, my question is, since there's no longer a reserve and all we have left is cash flow, if we would pass a bonding bill this session, there would be nothing, literally, to underwrite those bonds. So with the scenario, what I'm trying to get at is, unless we balance the budget, can we pass a bonding bill? That's the simplest. I have a couple of auxiliary questions, but that's the simplest question.
Ms. Novak.
Madam Chair and Representative Klausky, passing a bonding bill is a political act. And whether there is a reserve or not a reserve has more to do with fiscal management than the ability to get the supermajority of votes necessary to pass the bonding bill.
But wouldn't it be fair to say the first priority would be a balanced budget?
A balanced deficit.
Well, Madam Chair, that's my point, and you answered it correctly, that it would be, would the Department of Finance be able even to work with this bill until there was a balanced budget, considering there technically would be no funds to underwrite the bonds? I mean, you can't go into cash flow, can you, to underwrite these?
Ms. Novak.
Madam Chair and Representative Plotsky, the bonds that we sell are underwritten by the tax revenues of the state. And whether the state, well, the state is constitutionally required to have a balanced budget, but it always has tax revenues, and they would be, if necessary, there would be an imposition of a general property tax, too, to fund the bonds.
I'm wondering, Representative Pawlowski, if you know, in some states they have a continuing resolution, and the state and the government does not shut down. There is always a budget that is enacted, but we do not. And I suspect that because we don't have a continuing resolution, that would affect the answer.
Well, Madam Chair, my concern overall here is the promises we may or may not make this session. And I think it would be imprudent to make promises based on the premise that we really have no money to back up any of our promises, and even one that would be a capital investment bill where we're only underwriting a fraction of them. And I appreciate the answer about the tech. But the scope of our problem is extremely large. And if we're promising that we're going to even have a capital investment bill, it might be imprudent until we balance the budget. That's my general observation.
Did you have additional
questions? No, but I may have other questions.
Okay. When the department comes up, we have Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to Representative Erdahl's question or point here, I think we need to make sure we understand the 3%. The difference between 3% of non-dedicated general fund revenues and 3% of general government expenditures. They can be very different. And the 2.8% that's on this sheet is also, I believe, is it not, for 2007?
You used all Standard & Poor's numbers for 2007. I think her exercise was more for us to do some comparison about AAA ratings. What is that? We're trying to get a handle on what do AAA ratings mean? And by looking at seven or nine states that had it, I think that was our first step. So she was giving us the broad look. The department is going to give us the specific Minnesota law. Well, and I'm sure you'll speak more to that.
Madam Chair, my point simply is let's make sure we're talking about 3% of either revenue or expenditures and not confuse the two, because they may very well be different. And I'm going to save the rest of my questions regarding this point when the department comes forward.
Representative Scalzi, and again, these are the questions for the broad context, and then we'll get specific to Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Ms. Novak, my one question was, as you've looked through all of this information, and it seems as though these nine states are somewhat different in the way they do things, but are they more similar than all of the other states that are in there? I mean, appears to me to be some commonalities, and I'm just wondering if the other states are very different from these nine.
Ms. Novak?
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, I think these states are different from states that don't have AAA ratings in that they are considered by the rating agencies to be generally better managed.
Now, we should, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit because I think you consulted NCSL, and on the statement you just made, considered by rating agencies to be responsible or well managed, can you tell the group what NCSL said about Lehman Brothers?
Yeah.
Well, Madam Chair, NCSL, in talking to NCSL, and they were very helpful, actually, in getting the information for us, because rating agency Standard & Poor's is a private for-profit business, and we don't have access to this information except at very, very high cost. And so NCSL was able to get it for us, and we appreciate that. I'd like to thank them for that. But they also said there are two things. One, we're in a period of time where the reliability and the reputation of rating agencies has been called into question. And during the financial meltdown of the fall, late summer, the rating agencies continued to rate organizations like Lehman Brothers very highly. I believe they had the highest rated debt until the very day that they went into bankruptcy. And we're in a very volatile time, and that doesn't mean that they're not better at rating government entities than they are at rating private entities.
We're less secret, right? More transparent.
We have more transparency. The other story they told me is that when you question the validity of a AAA rating, kind of their advice based on what has happened in some other states is that the fundamental responsibility of the government is to manage its budget, to balance its budget, and to have good financial management, and not necessarily to chase a rating. And they told me the story of, I believe it was Kentucky, that, and I could be wrong on that because this is an anecdote, and a state that treasured its AAA rating, and it worked very hard to maintain it, and a number of years ago it got into a situation where it had to make, as a legislature, some difficult budgetary decisions that was going to, in the view of some of the legislators, jeopardize its rating. And to the extent that it disturbed some legislators so much, they had dramatic showings on the floor where they were tearing up their AAA rating and saying, this is what you're doing to our state. But they went ahead and made the budget decision, knowing that it was going to probably risk their rating. Several months later, they went into the market to sell debt, and they found that in that case their debt was fully subscribed. They were able to sell it all at a very competitive interest rate. And so the takeaway from that is, I believe the takeaway that they would say is manage the budget and the ratings will follow.
Representative Scott.
I think she just answered my question.
Okay. And Representative Colbert.
And we'll go on to the department.
Madam Chair, maybe someone else is going to do this as well, but in the memo from Ms. Dyson in December of 2008, we always concentrate on the 3%. And it's probably the simplest one to, but it's a guideline. And probably more ones we should pay attention to are some of the other ones that are listed as part of our guidelines. We don't have just one guideline. I think we have three or four guidelines.
And I'm guessing the department is going to, that is one of the pieces that.
Okay, that's,
so
the,
you
I'll
may,
wait with
yep,
that then.
Yep. So I think we're, thank you very much, Ms. Novak. And your agenda says Kathy Cardell and Mike Rollis, but I think we're joined by Kathy Cardell and Jim Showalter, right? So please join us. And we are now, you have two reports you're presenting. One is the overview of Minnesota debt management policy, and then the other is the debt capacity report from November of 2008. And we welcome you to the committee. Ms. Cardell, are you starting?
Madam Chair, yes, I am. Is this on? Can you hear me okay?
It is.
Okay.
And we have several handouts in the package from you. Is that right?
Hopefully.
Okay.
Wait till we get it up here on the screen. There we go. I had to bring the budget director so he could be my slide flipper.
And so what you have from them is a PowerPoint titled Debt Management Guidelines, and then you also have the memo from Tom Hansen. Those are the two you'll be referring to.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. My name is Kathy Cardell, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. We are going to, as Madam Chair said, there are two aspects to this presentation. First, we're going to talk about Minnesota's debt guidelines, and incorporated within the PowerPoint presentation is also the discussion of the debt capacity report that was released back concurrent with the November forecast. So with that, if we can get this thing to work. I'll begin.
And they do all have
struggle.
They do all have it in front of them.
With technology.
So.
On the first page, and as Ms. Novak indicated in her presentation, our debt management guidelines have been in place for quite a long time. The original set of guidelines was established first in 1979. And there were three objectives or goals attached with those guidelines. And the first, well, originally, the first guideline was to maintain AAA ratings. After we lost AAA ratings during the course of the years, we added the word regain. So maintain or regain AAA bond ratings. Now, the second goal is to minimize safe borrowing costs. If you think back to our presentation on Tuesday afternoon about debt management practices, I told you that the two most important concepts were the most important credit concept was the higher the credit, the lower the interest rate. And so minimizing state borrowing costs is an aspect of high credit ratings. And then the third goal was to provide a reasonable financing capacity within a prudent debt limit. And as Ms. Novak's presentation pointed out, debt management guidelines are important. But they are important because debt rating agencies see debt management guidelines and adherence to those guidelines as a reflection of our overall financial management policy. And I just wanted to remind the committee that rating agencies actually, when they look at our broad general obligation rating, they actually look at four factors. Financial or management policies, such as debt guidelines, are one of those four factors, but the other three are the economic situation that the state faces, the state's debt profile, and also our financial performance. Things like reserves, things like fund balances, so on and so forth. And when rating agencies think about debt guidelines, we feel that these are the things that they're looking for. And the first is, are they durable? Have they been utilized over a long period of time? And in fact, in our particular case, they have. Are they consistently applied? Have we adhered to them even when times were difficult? Are they comprehensive? Do they incorporate all of the state's obligations? And do they consider different measures? In our case, and we'll talk about this in a minute, we do look at multiple measures. Not every state does that. The rating agencies, and it was interesting, the questioning that was going on of Ms. Novak, because one of the reasons, for example, why Delaware has a very high percentage is because they issue debt for all of the political subdivisions in the state. And that is a factor that forces their debt burden higher. So rating agencies look at two basic measures. The one is the debt per capita, and the other is debt as a percentage of personal income of the state. And that's because that is really the only apples-to-apples comparison that they can make amongst the states. The questions that some of the committee members raised about, you know, revenues, if it's a percentage of revenues or if it's a percentage of expenditures, you know, that those, what makes up those sources, those categories in states, is very different from state to state. And so the rating agencies do not utilize that generally as any sort of a factor that they look at when they look at state credit broadly. There are benefits to having high standards. And the first is an interest rate benefit. Again, the higher the credit rating, the lower the cost of borrowing. And just as an example, since we were talking about our bond sale Tuesday, on the date of our bond sale, the difference in interest rates between a AAA-rated credit and a AA-rated credit was about 11 basis points in my bond lingo, or 0.11%. On our $325 million sale, if we had paid those extra 11 basis points, we would have added over $3.6 million of interest expense to that borrowing on just that issue. If you look at least in the market today, if you were going down to the next credit level, the A category credit level, the difference between a AAA credit and an A category credit, and I'll give you some examples. California is an A category credit right now, is over 1%. So it's a very significant factor, and it's going to, I think, continue to be a significant factor for the time being, certainly while the market continues to be a little bit dysfunctional.
And that just reminds me, Brooke, of Pawlowski's question earlier, because we just sold bonds this week.
We did.
And we don't have a balanced budget, and we have a huge projected deficit, and yet we were able to sell those bonds, and for that sale, they rated us AAA.
Madam Chair, they did, but I would say that they were very interested and very heartened by the fact that the $155 million of reserves had been utilized and that the governor had taken the allotment actions that he had taken in December.
So they were able to make a judgment about us based on our short-term balancing of the budget. What he seemed to be asking, though, is can we really pass bonding bills when we have deficits until we pass a balanced budget, but we were able, we had the capacity to
let's go to the next point, which is kind of, which is market access, what I call market access. And one of the things that we talked about is at the bond, at the bid opening for the bonds on Tuesday morning, actually, for those of you that were able to attend, was the fact that it was unusual that we sold those bonds in January after the start of a session, first of all. We would normally not sell bonds. We would prefer not to sell bonds because, and particularly after the governor's budget proposal is released and then there will be a new forecast and then you all will be deliberating on how to resolve the budget situation, there is so much uncertainty with respect to what is appropriate disclosure to potential buyers that we would
normally we would not do that. We would want to avoid that because we wouldn't know what to disclose, because we would not know what the ultimate outcome was going to be at that time. I think that the timing of the sale last Tuesday was, it was about as late as we could reasonably do and provide them with information and actions that meant that we were dealing with it as we could right now. Anything else? If I could just say one more thing about market access, though. When you don't...
I think maybe Representative Paul didn't want to follow.
Did you have a question?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Ms. Cardell, thank you. So, and you don't need to answer this, but I'll propose it anyway. We suspect that the budget problem will become larger in February, and that the governor will then do another unallotment, a significant unallotment, not small, but it's going to be significant. So using your scenario, those actions by the governor would then help authorize a bonding bill for this session. Am I correct in that interpretation?
Madam Chair and Representative Pulaski, I would not say authorize a bonding bill. I think what it would do, and we would do, is we would disclose and inform the credit rating agencies of the actions that have been taken to continue to address the problem.
Well, Madam Chair, Madam Chair and Ms. Cardell, can you tell us how big the action would have to be by the governor and where we would have to be in the process about what size of bonding bill? I mean, would it be the bonding bill you projected in the budget deficit, or do we have any idea here of the scope of what a bonding bill might be?
Madam Chair, Representative, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter. I'm State Budget Director. I just add in a little bit of clarification, and that is, when we presented to our rating agencies in the past, one of the things that we found to be a credit positive is the strong unallotments, quick reaction that Minnesota is able to take in order to right its fiscal situation. A lot of other states don't have that ability, and so they must wait for...
And in fact, that's in our characteristics.
Yes. So many other states will have to wait for many months in order to resolve that problem. When we disclosed what our new estimates were for fiscal 2009, Minnesota was in a position to take action. The governor, with some discussion with legislative leaders, took those actions and were able to put out a plan to balance the budget. In the middle of legislative session, I don't know that they would care necessarily whether it's a unallotment scenario or whether it's a quick bill from the legislature, so long as Minnesota continues to right its fiscal situation, do it promptly, do it in a fiscally prudent manner.
Well, Madam Chair, I bring it up because there are certain policy bills that may be introduced this session that deal with the powers of the governor.
One final comment on the market access issue, which is when you don't utilize good fiscal policies, your ability to access the credit markets can be compromised. And we've had a really good example of that recently, again, with the state of California, not to malign them too badly, but they are in a very serious liquidity cash flow crunch. They really needed to be able to sell short-term notes last fall. They had to ask their very prominent governor to do a public service announcement in order to entice people to try to buy those notes. They ended up selling fewer than what they needed. They did sell some, fewer than what they needed, and at a rate in excess of 4.5%. Now think about that, because we just sold 20-year bonds at 3.5%. So again, market access, the cost of capital, those are very important things to us in why our debt guidelines have been very useful. And the last thing is flexibility to adjust to changing conditions. We were able to pull back from a dysfunctional market last fall, falling back on our good cash flow position without compromising the progress of important capital projects. We delayed the GO bond sale, which we concluded successfully this week. We delayed the 911 revenue bond sale, which we completed about 6 weeks later than we originally anticipated. Nothing was disrupted. Everything continued as it was. And you know, it was good. I mean, it was great. But there were several state issuers during that same time period who were forced to go to market because if they didn't, they would have to halt construction projects all around the state.
And Kentucky is a good example. It was funny that Ms. Novak mentioned them, because Mr. Showalter who came into my office after a budget, state budget officer's call and said, I don't think you're going to believe this, but Kentucky is just really happy that they sold bonds at over 6%. And I'm like, well, that would be not something I would be excited about, but they needed to. And Ohio was in the same situation. So those are some of the benefits of having high standards and adhering to them.
Madam Chair, if I can add
one. Mr. Showalter.
As we were comparing notes about Ms. Novak's presentation, and as you're trying to summarize what is high standards, because there are so many different factors that you're trying to assess, and those are the same factors that the rating agencies are trying to assess. One of the common elements that Kathy and I came to was liquidity.
Yeah.
That all the states you're looking at have relatively conservative financial practices with healthy reserves, low levels of debt. None of them were doing short-term borrowing for cash flow purposes, and that investors were well comfortable with the idea that the state had enough cash to pay back quickly.
Right.
Those are one of the factors that, you know, as we put this most recent bond, that set of bonds up, our reserve levels were one of the factors that rating agencies were starting to look at and question whether we had adequate reserves.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Ms. Cardell, I don't really think it's a big surprise that Minnesota is able to sell bonds at a pretty reasonable rate when, if they're not going to be paid off, I mean, the Constitution says we have to pay that off before we do anything else. So it's a pretty good bet that those bonds are going to be paid off. If we've got to sell something, we're going to pay those bonds off. Do other states have that same requirement that we do, that the first, I mean, you pay the bonds first before you think about anything else?
Many states do. Cardell. Madam Chair, yes, Representative, yes, many states do. Any state that sells general obligation bonds, not every state does, but most of them do, they have the same requirement that we do.
Okay.
Continue. And the next slide is the one that gets at the point Representative Colbert made earlier, and that is...
And first, yes, and this is, Madam Chair, this is very good, because Representative Colbert hit on my opening comment before we click on this slide, which is that even though the 3% guideline is the one that receives all the attention, there are actually five that we use. So we're going to talk about each one of them one at a time. And the first is the general fund appropriation for debt service shall not exceed 3% of non-dedicated general fund revenues. What does that mean? This is an important guideline because this is the only one of the five that speaks to debt service rather than amount of bonds outstanding. It's the only one that speaks to the non-dedicated general fund revenues. And what it includes is our general obligation various purpose bonds only. Those are the ones like the $325 million that we sold on Tuesday that funds everything from MNSU and the U of M projects to DEED and DNR and all of those. Does not include trunk highway. Does not include any other obligations that we pay from general fund resources. And this guideline is, I suspect, the primary focus because it is the one that has the bottom line budget impact. The others don't really. The second guideline is the total general obligation debt of the state, including trunk highway, shall not exceed 2.5% of personal income, that's state personal income. That is a guideline that looks at the total amount, or what we call the total par amount, of bonds outstanding. The third guideline, very different approach here, this guideline says that state agency debt shall not exceed 3.5% of state personal income. This is again, reflects the total amount of bonds outstanding by these state agencies, and it includes everything, well, I've got the list, but it's Minnesota Housing, it's the Public Facilities Authority, the Higher Education Facilities Authority, the Office of Higher Education, the Met Council, I mean, just a whole raft of state agencies. And I presume, I wasn't here when these guidelines were implemented, but it makes sense to me that this was a measure that so that people could look and say, aha, state agencies are not running wild with issuing their own debt. The fourth guideline is a comprehensive look at all state general obligation debt, so that's both various purpose and trunk highway. Moral obligation debt of the state, we provide a moral obligation pledge on bonds, certain bonds, of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. State bond guarantees, when we had Northwest Airlines debt outstanding, we don't anymore, but when we did, those bonds had a state guarantee. Equipment capital leases and real estate leases are not to exceed 5% of state personal income. And again, this reflects the total amount or par amount of debt outstanding, does not include our contingent obligations with respect to school district credit enhancement or city and county credit enhancement programs. It does not include the standing appropriations for the University of Minnesota projects or the Minnesota Housing Finance Supportive Housing Bonds. The last guideline is a structuring guideline which speaks to amortization, and it requires that 40% of our bonds be repaid within 5 years and 70% be repaid within 10 years.
And if I understand, of these five, it is the second, if we want to look at how we fare across the states, the second is the really the only one where you could really make some assumptions across the states, right?
Madam Chair, I would say that the second one is too narrow because it only takes into account, if you're talking about the rating agencies, and how maybe if they're the source of the data kind of for comparing mm-hmm. across states.
Or even of our own, trying to figure out where are we really. And
mm-hmm. I would say that would need to be broadened to include more of our general fund obligations. But, again, that would be consistent with the way when the rating agencies calculate our per capita debt, for example. They include a lot more obligations than what we include when we calculate that.
Representative Solberg had a question.
Madam Chair and Ms. Kendall or Mr. Showalter, do we have numbers on the other guidelines?
You see it in the next slide.
They're coming.
Oh, next. Okay.
Yep, they're
very
coming.
Good. Thank you.
They're coming.
Representative Wheeler. Oh, I'm sorry.
I just would like to clarify okay. on other types of state obligations, just so people have a concrete example on our general fund balance. We have debt service as one of the early sort of summary lines of state spending areas. But there's another one called capital projects. There's only a few items in there, but like the TCF Bank Stadium is an example where the state is providing money to the University of Minnesota to help build that stadium, and that debt is actually shining through to the state's creditworthiness, not necessarily the University of Minnesota's. That's an example of something that Assistant Commissioner Cardell was talking about.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Cardell, I have a question, and that is, where are we right now with the bonds that we have out? How much can we borrow if we're to stay under the 3%?
Representative Scott, Madam Chair, I think what we've got in this presentation is sort of a historical snapshot showing where we've been and where we're projected to be at the end of this biennium, and then we have another one later that talks about where the debt capacity for it would be projecting us to be going out 6 years.
So you're saying you're still coming?
We're still coming.
Okay, coming back. With Representative Scott, further question?
No, Madam.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the first bullet point, just to be clear, because the 3/8% sales tax increase from the Constitution is dedicated, that's dedicated in the four funds, it doesn't count into that calculation.
Representative and Madam Chair, that is correct.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The third bullet point now, I know at least, and I don't know in Minnesota, at least in some states, agencies can do revenue bonds. Does that count here, or do we have none? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, yes. The calculation of the debt for the state agencies in Guideline 3 includes both revenue debt and general obligation debt. Some of those agencies have both types of debt outstanding.
And then, just moving on, we've got about 15 minutes left.
One thing, I just wanted to go back. Sorry. Just on the 40-70 structuring requirement, that's a very aggressive repayment structure. It's looked at very favorably by the credit rating agencies, but it also limits our flexibility. We had an example last summer where we had what we call an inverted yield curve, where short-term rates were actually higher than long-term rates, where if you were thinking about this from a financial management perspective, you might actually want to push debt service out because you would be paying less. Our debt service is so front-loaded with this structure, but we don't have the ability to do that within the context of these guidelines. So that's just kind of a concrete example that was fairly recent. The next slide, I think, speaks to a Representative Scott's question. This is the most recent history of the guidelines. That we only include the four in the table because all of the debt is structured to meet the 40-70. All of the state debt, I should say, structured to meet the 40-70 guidelines. And you can see that for 04, 05, and 06, 07, generally, certainly on the 3% guideline, the trend is up. There's an asterisk next to the 2008-09 because that is estimated based on the November forecast.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you can help me understand this 3% guideline on the 2008-09, it shows we're under the 3%. We heard from our state economists that without spending, without any bonding bill at all, we're going to exceed the 3%. Now, can you explain, reconcile for me how we, without spending any additional, go above the 2.68 that's shown here? Because the 2.68 assumes the $120 million bonding that we would normally do this year. So can you reconcile those numbers for me?
And is that what you're going to get up on these two pages?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, it is. And I would say we are going to talk about that in the context of the debt capacity report itself because we were projected to go over the 3% in 2010 and 11. In the next biennium, not in the 2008-09. But I would also say as a caution that this is an estimated number that will be revised based on the February forecast. And so whatever happens with that forecast will also affect this number.
So, follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it is possible that after the February forecast, the 2.68 will go up.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, that is correct.
Thank you.
Continue?
Yep. The next slide introduces the concept of the debt capacity report. I just reiterated the statute itself. It's a short statute that requires the preparation of this report. It's 16A-105. For those of you that maybe are not as familiar with it, I thought I would include it. But let's go on to the next slide and talk about the underlying assumptions of the debt capacity forecast. The first thing that people need to realize or understand is that it uses a 10-year rolling average to estimate first the large capital budgets in each even-numbered year legislative session. And so in the November report, the amount that 10-year rolling average yielded was $725 million of bonding in the even years. We also use that same 10-year rolling average to estimate the emergency capital budgets in each odd-numbered year legislative session. And in November of 2008, that yielded $125 million of bonding. These figures are incorporated, the debt service figures are incorporated into each November and February forecast, and it is used to determine the maximum amount of future capital budgets, the maximum amount, staying within the 3% guideline. Now let's talk a little bit about the November forecast itself. The statute requires us to look at through a six-year period, so in this case, The forecast covers the period through the 2014-15 biennium. It utilizes the non-dedicated general fund revenues from the November 2008 forecast. And, those revenues are all of the tax revenues. It's non-tax revenues, things like lottery proceeds, departmental earnings and fees, investment income, so forth, and transfers from other funds. Largest is probably the health impact fee, some others, lots of miscellaneous special revenue transfers. But it requires us to say what the outstanding general obligation debt was. As of 12/1/08, it was $4,254,705,000. That amount includes our general obligation trunk highway bonds. We are also required to identify the authorized but unissued general obligation debt. As of 12/1/08, that amount was $3,142,620,400. That also includes the general obligation trunk highway bonds that are authorized. The debt service costs are also required to be included. Those costs, however, only incorporate debt service on general obligation bonds paid out of the general fund. So again, that takes out trunk highway, but it leaves in our various purpose capital projects. Those debt service costs range from an actual amount of over $409 million in fiscal year 08 to a forecast of $613 million in fiscal year 2015. Again, this excludes trunk highway, and this is based on those capital budget amounts that we saw on the previous slide, $725 million, $120 million.
Mr. Showalter, as we were preparing this presentation, one of these points startled me, which was the second from last one, that there's over $3 billion of authorized but unissued bond appropriations that are already in existence. And while a significant portion of those are related to trunk highway funds, I just want to bring it home a little bit. When we talk about the 3% guideline, that's related to debt service. That is, bonds that have already been issued, which were paying debt. This number says that there's more than $1 billion of other general fund GL debt that's still been authorized but hasn't actually been issued. So were we to issue those, our debt service would continue to rise.
Do you know what percentage would be trunk highway as opposed to?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the total authorization was about the $1.8 billion. They've issued a little bit of that. I'm looking at you, Norman, how much? Maybe a little bit more than $70 million. So I mean, it's a pretty large number. I got to believe it's around 1.65 to 1.7 billion that is still authorized but unissued for trunk highway.
Probably contracted though.
Oh well, we'll leave that for MnDOT.
But I think the insight is just simply that it is the 3% guideline is only one of five guidelines, but it also refers to how much we're paying for debt service on already issued debt. Just because debt is authorized or GO bonds are authorized depends on how quickly those are used that it really gets to how it affects the debt service. And that there's already a sizable amount that's already authorized that we will continue to finance and make sure those projects are good.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Showalter, so what are the chances that those that are authorized but haven't been, what did you
issued.
Say? Issued. That they're going to be issued?
Representative Murphy, very high. If you think back to our presentation on Tuesday when we talked about the cancellation report, since I think it went back to 03, there were only $22 million of bond projects that are being canceled that were not going forward. So I think it's very, very high likelihood that most, if not a very high percentage of those bonds will ultimately be issued.
Follow-up, Representative Murphy?
No.
Okay. Continue.
And just let's continue.
We have just about 5 more minutes. So
there's other important variables. Interest rates on bonds sold, they change all the time, as we all know. Premiums paid on bonds sold, that changes with market conditions as well. Interest rates for investment earnings on balances, unfortunately, interest rates are very, very low for investments, so we're not going to do very well in that area in the near term. Receipts deposited into the debt service fund from non-general fund sources, those are primarily the user finance projects, the one-third from the universities, and so on and so forth. The cash flow requirements for future capital projects, if cash flow needs are accelerated, then we have to issue more bonds, then the debt service requirements go up. Conversely, cash flow requirements slow down, the opposite happens. The timing of the bond sales also makes a difference. The fact that we did not sell the bonds in October when the market was not working means that our debt service went down in fiscal year 09 but went up more than it otherwise would have in fiscal year 10. And then the last slide, again, I can speak to Representative Scott's question. We only in the debt capacity forecast look, we only talk about the 3% ratio because the forecast specifically asks us to talk about debt service requirements. So you can see here that based on the November forecast, we are projected to exceed the 3% in each of the three biennia included here. We also did the calculation for this presentation of what we estimate the total GO debt to personal income ratio to be. Again, remember that's our various purpose capital project debt and also trunk highway. There are two caveats I'd like to say about that. The first is that this ratio is going to, because it includes the trunk highway, is going to be sensitive to the timing of the issuance of the large trunk highway authorization. We've made some assumptions, but, you know, it can change. The second thing that I wanted to point out to you is something that I've talked with Dr. Stinson about, which is that the GII projection of personal income for the state in the November forecast is too optimistic, and that those numbers are going to come down, which means these ratios are going to go up. The last two guidelines, state agency debt to personal income and all state obligations to personal income, we cannot calculate because we do not know what state agencies are going to be issuing. We do not know what sort of additional obligations or guarantees we may be taking in the future. So they are not a ratio or calculation that's done on a forecast basis.
There is one other packet of information that I thought we would hand out, and it's for your take-home reading. And if you would just stay there for a minute, if I could just sort of summarize, because I've spent a lot of time reading all the Standard & Poor's things and some of the articles you're going to be getting, and just had some observations that I would be interested in your response. First of all, Standard & Poor's reports, those reports, you have one of them. You have the 2008, I believe, that looked at all the states. I was intrigued by the titles. In 2007, Standard & Poor's said, state debt issuances are likely to accelerate with substantial infrastructure needs. And then in 2008, the title was, states weather credit market disruptions but are likely to step up borrowing as economy slows. So the very title of Standard & Poor's reports seem to suggest universally all states are likely to increase their borrowing. And the one particularly from July 2008, likely to step up borrowing as economy slows, which suggests that Standard & Poor's is acknowledging that national discussion about capital investment as economic stimulus. Would that be fair?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that that's fair. And I also think that when they talk about borrowing, they're talking about borrowing for stimulus for infrastructure, but they're also talking about borrowing for cash flow purposes, which we're seeing a great deal more of by states right now. So I think that your statement is accurate, and I think it encompasses an even broader array of borrowing as well.
And then as we looked at Ms. Novak's chart of the seven or nine states, depending on what year, I guess, that have AAA bond rating and not similar characteristics, the one overriding feeling comes from, and I don't know if this is in your packet, top 10 management characteristics of highly rated credits, this strong theme of management. And their quote is, management can positively affect ratings in a number of ways. Conversely, the lack of strong management can be a significant factor in a weak credit profile. But management will be one of the deciding factors. So as we talk and as we message to the press and as they ask us questions, we are so fixated on that 3%. But as I read page after page, the whole broad way about how we conduct ourselves and how we're going to deal with this credit crisis and are we going to kind of honestly address what's before us seems to be overriding and universal. Would that be fair?
Madam Chair, I completely agree, and I would say that in my experience in this business since 1985 that it is when times are really difficult that management practices and the management criteria really come to the forefront. It's so important to have good practices and to have that work. And so I would agree.
And then Representative Wagenius called these articles to my attention that I'm distributing from the New York Times. And these we put in your packet because we talk about that 3% somehow as sacred, and we tried to put it in a broader context. But we also have sort of thought of the rating agencies as sacred, and that and these articles suggest that lest we think ratings and rating agencies are sacred, that that in this whole economic implosion, that even there. We have some reason to wonder whether they should be our primary driver as we think through our own state's issues.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I would agree that the rating agencies, and this was kind of Ms. Novak's assessment too, have certainly taken a major credibility hit with good reason. I'm not sure that it's entirely appropriate within the government sector, but nevertheless, I don't disagree with that. But I would say that irregardless, in what I have heard from institutional investors in some educational calls that we've been conducting through the State Debt Managers Network, credit is going to be important, whether it's credit as determined by Fitch, Moody's, and Standard & Poor's, or whether it's credit as evaluated by a portfolio manager at a large insurance company that's considering buying a large piece of our bonds. And so I think that the good policies and good management is going to be important irregardless.
And then the final article I gave you was just recently in Finance and Commerce, and there are quotes from two local experts from several different perspectives that I thought was interesting. One is a St. Paul firm that counsels local and state governments on management and public finance issues. And she says, a spike in bond issuances wouldn't necessarily harm that rating, but it could contribute to tougher scrutiny. The agencies will give a very broad review to Minnesota's financial picture. It's simplistic to say that raising the debt ceiling would alter the ratings. The agency will look at the state's spending and its plan for repayment and make their judgments on that. And then they go on to say the state may indeed find tougher going, I think this is the finance director for the city of Minneapolis, who was a former financial advisor to states and cities, says if the state, after all its deliberations, can produce a budget that's structurally balanced, but it also increases its bonds and debt service, the rating services would be hard-pressed to lower the state's rating. Then they quote a professor at the University of Minnesota School of Management who says, investors are risk-averse now, and they've pulled away from a lot of public finance bonds, forcing issuers to pay higher yields. And, of course, what we discovered this week is that is not true for Minnesota. In our bond sale, the investors were eager, six investors, and they didn't pull away and seemed to say the promise continues to be great for Minnesota.
But I would say, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that that is because Minnesota is regarded as one of the strongest credits still, that people are confident that we're going to resolve our budgetary difficulties in a way that is financially smart, and that there are, in fact, many issuers of lesser credit quality. He's right in that respect, that they are not being able to access the market.
Madam Chair, Ms. Kendall, I don't remember for sure, but in the issuing that we just did on Tuesday, the report from the Department of Finance in November came out, though, and said that we had, in effect, with that particular shortfall in our collections, had exceeded the 3% by a small amount. And we have up in here, it's projected, if we do what we traditionally have done, I think that's based on $120 million of issuance this year. Is that correct? We would be exceeding the 3%. And my question is, was that information given to the rating agency or to the bond bidders on this last issuance?
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, yes, it was. In fact, when the debt capacity report was released, I personally contacted each of the rating agencies to advise them of what the capacity report showed in terms of our forecast and that we would be exceeding.
And even though we exceeded, we got a very, very good interest rate.
And a AAA bond rating for that sale.
Okay. Although, Madam Chair, and we did have outlook changes by both Moody's and Fitch, which is not without note.
But, Madam Chair, I think every state has had outlook changes by Moody's, Standard & Poor's.
Different numbers with, yes.
Members, we have reached the end of our time. There's no meeting next Tuesday. The next meeting is on Thursday, and we're going to be looking at the progress of some of the bonding that we've authorized, and specifically that one is the University of Minnesota NINSU. And then Representative Dean, I think, asked at the last meeting, do we have any total summary of everything we've let and what the summary is? At first I said, oh, we'll get that to everyone. Then I saw the size of it. So we've only made a few copies. If somebody really is interested, they're here, and you may take this back to your office. But there is a tracking of all authorization and where we are on all of it. So they're here if somebody has a real interest in that. Representative Eastman.
So is that a documentation of the $1.5 billion that has not been let yet?
No.
Ms. Cardell.
It's everything. It's bonds that have been issued where we've only, it's all of the open bond authorizations, basically, whether we've issued bonds yet or not for some portion of it.
Bonds that have not been paid off yet in the 3 years are in that report.
But the $3 billion that we were talking about that have not even been, that have been authorized but haven't been issued yet, are those in there too?
Well,
except the Trump Highway ones?
Well, they're there.
They're there.
I think the answer is yes. Right. Seeing no further questions.
One point of clarification is in that the document the university authorizations for the future for
the research lab.
The research lab and.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, it is not because it is not general obligation debt. It is a general standing appropriation.
Stadium is not.
Stadium is not.
Okay.
No further questions. Meeting is adjourned.